Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Do you like Sheffield Live? Why not become a friend of Sheffield Live? Sheffield Live is a community radio station, and friends of Sheffield Live are people in the community who make a regular donation to keep Sheffield Live on the air. Join the Friends of Sheffield Live by writing to friends@sheffieldlive.org or go online to sheffieldlive.org/friends.
Hello, good evening. Here we are again, Deserted Island Dis. It's the show that brings people who are associated with Ireland to come to talk on the show for an hour, who now live in Sheffield, and we have an hour of listening to their music choices and about their life. So I am gradually running out of people who are born in Ireland that want to do the show, but that doesn't matter. We still have great people here, and especially a great person tonight. So I've got Phil Tebbutt in the studio tonight. Hello, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. I'm fine.
Good God. Phil is an amazing folk singer who you'll find singing in Fagin's couple of nights a week, at least, isn't it, Phil?
Yeah, usually a couple of nights a week, yeah.
Yeah, so I've known Phil. I must have saw Phil sing probably 25 years ago in Fagin's, but I never spoke to him. I was kind of that Fagin's crowd where they're all fantastic musicians and then slightly, you know, just out of my league to talk to. But then I saw him one day in the Grapes, which is still an amazing pub. And I approached Phil and I said, "All right, Phil, how are you doing? I've seen you in Fagin's." And that must have been about 6-7 years ago, Phil.
Yeah, about that.
And
like that.
Since then, we always have a chat. And he's very kindly agreed to be on the show tonight. So thanks, Phil.
No problem.
So, Phil, what year were you born? 1950. And you're born in Grimsby, you're telling me?
I was, yeah, in the Belvedere Nursing Home, Grimsby.
Okay. So you've done loads of things in your life that we're going to talk about in the hour. I'd like to give the audience just an indication of where we're going. So you were a teacher, and you've done lots of travelling around all parts of the world and spent lots of time in Ireland. So we're going to cover all that off in the hour. But let's start at the beginning, Phil. So What was Grimsby like, and your parents, and what's your earliest memories there?
Well, my earliest memories are really of being in a pram. I remember my mum saying to me, "Come and see what you've done." I'd had measles, and there was no MMR at that time. I'd had measles, and I had a younger brother who was, so he'd be 2.5 years younger than me, and he was a baby. And I'd been isolated in the bedroom. Yeah. With measles, with the curtains drawn, because it might damage your eyesight.
Okay.
And after I'd recovered, my mum took me out and held me hand and said, "And come and look what you've done," and lifted me up and showed me into the pram, lifted me up, and I can see my brother, my little Paul, who's now living in New Zealand, and he was covered in spots.
So I
broke into tears because I felt it was my fault. So that's my earliest memory, literally.
Oh, right. Well. So what Grimsby then? So you mum and dad from Grimsby as well?
My mum was from Grimsby. Yeah, they were both from Grimsby, although my dad's family came from Brigg in Lincolnshire.
Right.
His family were originally agricultural migrants who come up from Northamptonshire.
Yeah.
My mother had been in the area, mother's family had been in the area a long time.
Yeah.
And they both came from the same part of Grimsby, an area that's called the West Marsh, and they tentatively knew each other before they got together. They'd been to the same junior school. My dad was 2 years younger than my mum, so they obviously didn't mix.
Yeah.
But then when he came back from the war, they got together, and that was basically it.
All right. So, had you in 1950? But are you the oldest, or is he?
I'm the oldest of five.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, right.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was fairly common. You're in that kind of generation, I suppose, of people that came back after the war. And
yeah. I suppose it was really. I mean, my dad. He's to say he knew her. My mother had worked in an armaments factory in Leicester, and it was the first time at the age of 18 that she'd ever left home. And
so was that? Was she kind of made to do that? Or was
not
that,
made to do it. It was just something that you know. Yeah. She said it was just what everybody wanted to do.
Everybody did something. Yeah. So I mean, I suppose a lot of people would have come to Sheffield and worked in.
Women. And she talked about it afterwards later, and she realised how dangerous it was.
Yeah.
And what they were handling.
The sort of things that like bombs and grenades.
Oh, God, yeah. And they were handling dangerous chemicals as well.
Yeah.
But she always said, and she used to say this with a big smile on her face, she said it was one of the happiest times of my life. Because she'd suddenly been released, you know.
Yeah. From freedom.
Her mother was quite a firm,
very
strict mother. Her father was a sweet, sweet man. He was lovely.
So you remember them?
I do remember them. Nana and Grandad, yeah. And her mother was, she had Romani blood in her, and which is where I think I get my dark looks. And well, not dark now, but and she was a fierce character, actually. And you know, my mother used to tell quite fearsome stories about if she stayed out 1 minute later than she should have done.
In trouble.
Big trouble. It was a coat hanger that she used.
Okay.
Beat her with a coat hanger to go
upstairs. Not one of them little wire ones, was it?
No, it was a wooden one, one with a nice sharp metal bit on it.
But I mean, that's kind of news to me that I suppose women did that from around the country to go to different places. Did she go with, presume, like a friend's?
There were a number of them went. And they had digs, as they called it. And then she'd go home periodically and then go back. And I've got a letter that was passed on to me after she died that her father, my granddad, sent to her while she was there, after she'd first gone out. He's very protective and very loving, and he said, just be careful. And he'd been in the RAF in the 1920s, and he knew what, you know, servicemen were like. And he said, just keep your eye open, you know. And the irony of it was she did meet and fall in love with a Canadian airman. And he died. He got shot down. My dad came back, and she.
Well, that's, you know, kind of they got you, together. What did your dad do in the war then?
My dad was in North Africa. He was in Egypt, and then because he'd signed up, because he was born in 1926, he only spent the last year of the war in North Africa, and the campaign had been victorious. El Alamein had taken place obviously before that.
Okay, because he was really young then.
He had the last year of the war there, and one of his favourite books was Spike Milligan's first book, Adolf Hitler and My Part in His Downfall. Spike Milligan was there at the same time, and he loved the Goons, so he almost identified with it.
And is your dad, you were saying earlier, had quite a big influence in your music, on like your music, yeah?
I didn't realise he was having an influence on me at the time, but he sang all the time, and he would sing along with things on the radio, and he had this fantastically wide Catholic taste in music. He loved Bing Crosby, who he referred to only as Bing, as though he was some sort of good mate of his. But he also loved classical music. He loved choral music. He loved Kathleen Ferrier, who I hated at the time because I just couldn't stand, you know. I just had no sensitivity towards it. But I have since come to really love Kathleen Ferrier and her voice. And I remember Blow the Wind Southerly being a song that, you know, if he came on the radio, he'd turn it right up. My mother used to love that as well, and she had a big thing. Because Kathleen Ferrier was a working class woman from Lancashire.
I don't know her.
Honestly, a stunning, stunning voice. Blow the Wind Southerly, you might have heard, was the most famous thing that was played over and over again on the radio. So he loved anything. The only music he loved that I didn't eventually come to love was Gilbert and Sullivan operas.
You still don't like that now?
No, I'm not. But he had he loved jazz, he loved, you know, he just had a great you know.
Yeah, yeah, fantastic.
Very
yeah.
wide taste, and you
well,
sing it.
What we should have said at the beginning is that Phil is going to sing us a song live in the studio. He's got an amazing voice, and we're going to probably the third song in. We're going to get to sing live,
right?
But you were saying that your dad loved jazz, and that links us to your first choice of songs.
Yeah,
there, so.
Yeah. One of the things I distinctly remember was Fats Waller. He used to like Fats Waller. He loved his voice. And this is the song I remember. Whenever it came on the radio, we would play it.
So, yeah,
and turn it up.
Ain't Misbehaving. Ain't Misbehaving, Fat Sweller. That take you back?
It does. It does. I can see the inside of the house, the terraced house we lived in now. Yeah.
And what, and were you saying that you didn't have a record player?
No. My dad, he was singing, he'd use the radio all the time. The radio was always on, usually the light programme. But he got hold of, and I can't remember how he did it, and it was when I was about 5 or 6, he got hold of a Grundig reel-to-reel tape recorder, which was his favourite toy for years. And he used that to bring more music into the house because he would assiduously sit next
steal
to...
stuff, yeah.
He'd steal stuff off the radio.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of his favourite thing was, I don't know if anybody listened to this or remember this, two-way or three-way family favourites,
yeah.
Which was a Sunday afternoon, Sunday lunchtime programme where they'd play requests from the British forces who were still based in Germany even then,
yeah.
10 years later,
yeah.
and songs that they were sending back home. And he used to record and record and record, and then he'd play them back afterwards to himself, and he'd miss things out and cut them down. He'd cut it, made himself a tape of these things.
Oh, so he'd edit it, kind of?
Yeah. With a little knife.
Yeah, you know, How did he learn to do
that? Yeah. Just because he wanted to do it, and he wanted to put these tapes. He was very proud of them, so he had these reel-to-reel tapes.
Yeah, you got any left?
Well, I think we have got some somewhere. I'll have to ask my sister about them, but I'm pretty sure they're around somewhere.
And how would you play them now?
Who knows? Well, you'd have to take them to a studio and get them transferred onto CD or whatever, you know.
So we'd
always have this music, and there were certain favourite things he would have, you know, and he'd love certain songs. But he just sang. And eventually he ended up with a male voice choir. That in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years of his life, he was with a male voice choir.
Oh, right. Yeah. And, well, that's, I mean, that's, when people hear your voice, it does sound like male voice choir, doesn't it? In my opinion, is that
no, I don't know. I don't know.
That's not an insult.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. No. I love male voice choirs myself. I lived in Wales for a year, and I just, you know, it makes me cry sometimes listening to the really good ones.
Yeah, amazing. You know, the Welsh ones are fantastic.
Sensational.
And the Yorkshire ones.
Yes. Well, Lincoln. It was Lincolnshire in his case. It was Louth male voice choir that he sang with.
Right. Yeah. So let's get back to you, Phil. We're already a quarter way through the show. I mean, we need to talk about... Well, let's talk about your school days, teenage years. What was that like?
I passed the 11 plus, went to grammar school, met a lot of friends who I've still got, after all these years. And at that, towards the end of that period, in the sixth form, I got involved with a folk club that had been set up by a couple of lads older than me. And that's where I got into folk music, really. The usual way, Bob Dylan, Tom Paxton, all the American singers, you know. I wasn't even aware of English traditional folk music or Irish.
Yeah.
And then the Clancy Brothers and so Rebel Songs. And so, you know, that's where I first performed. The first song I ever performed in public, which I'd learnt, was Can't Help But Wonder Where I'm Bound by Tom Paxton.
Yeah.
And that was it, really.
So when you say in public, was that the kind of part of the folk club?
Yeah.
So you get up and do it in the folk club. So
there was one...
You practice in your bedroom first, though?
Who knows where I practiced, I used to sing as a duet with a lad called Nick Todd, who sadly died, who loved the guitar, and he played the guitar, and he idolised Bert Jansch.
Yeah.
And he forced himself to learn...
Wow.
Angie, which everybody
learned. Well, it's difficult, isn't it?
He did as well.
But it's like, I mean, because now people just go on the internet and get a lesson, don't they? But that back then...
He just played the record over.
It's just amazing how people do that, isn't it? Just to kind of get there and do it.
So that was it, really. That was the folk... I'd got the bug then. And it was popular, you know. There were some good people there. And people who've gone on to make, you know... certain careers in folk music to some extent.
Because folk was cool back then, wasn't it?
It became cool. Folk clubs were starting up. There was a very good one in Grimsby. The Grimsby and Cleethorpes Folk Club in the Lifeboat at Grimsby. And the people who ran it, well, you'll probably know straight away when I say the name, John Connolly, who wrote Fiddler's Green. Bill Meek, who was a teacher at my school. And they were in a band called The Broadside.
Yeah.
And they ran the club, and that's when I first went to a folk club. And that's when I really got hooked, because I saw all the big names, Ewan McCall, Peggy Seeger, Martin Carthy. Yeah. They were all there, you know, and they're all just travelling around, sleeping on floors and stuff like that. And it was
amazing.
And I'll plug a Sheffield author here, J.P. Bean, who wrote the best thing that's ever been written so far about the folk revival. Singing from the floor, and he just pins it down exactly.
Oh, we'll have a look at that. Yeah, that sounds fantastic. We'll have a look. Should we do another song? So you've done Blackwater Side, is it? Which is that kind of...
Yeah, it's. I've picked it for a couple of reasons. One is that it's an Irish song and the Irish thing comes in next. And secondly, it's sung by probably my favourite traditional folk singer of all time, Anne Briggs, whose voice I fell in love with when I first heard it. And I still think is just sensational. So it's her version of Blackwater Side. And it's also the sort of theme that I'm always very keen on, which is to do with romance and misery.
Okay, lovely. Blackwater Side.
One morning fair to take the air down by Blackwater Side. Was in gazing all around me. 'Twas the Irish lad I spied all through. While we lay in sport and play, then this young man he arose and he gathered his clothes. He said, "Fare thee well today." Well, that's not the promise that you gave to me when first you lay on my bed. You could make me believe with your lying tongue that the sun rose in the west. Then go home, go home to your father's garden. You go home and weep your and you think of your own misfortune that you brought with your wants and will. For there's not a girl in this whole as easily led as I. Sure, it's fishers they'll fly, and the seas run dry. 'Tis then he'll
that's lovely, that. That's Anne Briggs, who's new to me, Phil. So my guest, Phil Tebbutt's choice on Deserted Dining Days tonight. And fantastic. So I didn't know much about Anne there. But you were telling me just then, really, about kind of some of the history to her. Just want to share with the audience.
Well, she was on the scene from the late 50s onwards. A.L. Lloyd, who was the sort of, you know, the man who was sort of very much sort of the expert everybody went to for it. He tried to promote her and encourage her to sing. She just liked singing, full stop. She just enjoyed singing. She hated studios. She hated being pinned down. She'd take bookings, you know, now and again, but she wasn't interested, really. She got together with, I think it was Johnny Moynihan in Sweeney's Men, and they were travelling around, you know, going around Ireland and singing in pubs and playing music, and she had a wild time with him and enjoyed it. And she ended up, and I think, and I'd like to think she's still there, I hope she is, I haven't heard otherwise, she ended up in the far northwest of Scotland, living in a remote cottage and, you know, very content. She'd been through a hard life. She led a hard life, and she was, but I just think there's something raw and beautiful about her voice, which I've always loved.
Well, you was telling me that she was the subject of Beeswing. Beeswing is, I mean, if people don't know, it's Christy Moore. I mean, it's Richard Thompson, folk singer, wrote it, but Christy Moore covered it. If people from the Irish genre or background know Christy Moore's that, and basically it's about a woman who's wild and amazing.
Yeah.
But she ends up sleeping rough in Derby, I think the song says. That's news to me that that's that woman.
It isn't absolutely. Richard Thompson says it's not all about her.
Yeah,
but
so it's,
clearly she's the model for it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the first time I heard the song, I thought that's Anne Briggs. It's got to be. And sadly, I never saw her live.
Where is a bee's wing? So. Great. Okay, let's get back to you, sorry. We digress, but that's okay for the show. So we'd got to kind of your teenage years and you'd done your A-levels.
Well, I went to university, Essex University, and I got together with a bunch of people who liked folk music. A bloke called Ian Noble was the leading light. And we all shared a flat together in Clacton-on-Sea. He managed to negotiate a very, very generous grant for the folk club. I mean, it wasn't the sort of university that was into folk music at all. And we could pay to get the best people. And I'll just tell one story from that. They all used to come, as they did in those days, and stay with you. That was part of the deal. So Martin Carthy, Shirley Collins, John Kirkpatrick, they all came. I think my favourite memory was that one night Ian had booked the Humble Bums, who some of you might have heard of. And the Humble Bums featured, among others, Billy Connolly,
Jerry Rafferty.
Rab Noakes and Jerry Rafferty.
Yeah.
And they came, and it was empty. It was just us who led the folk club, just us, six or seven of us, and the Humble Bums. And at that point, Billy Connolly hadn't been heard of.
Yeah.
But it was pretty obvious. I mean, he was the front man. And they said, oh, don't bother about it. You know, we're being paid because they were getting the full fee.
Yeah.
We'll just give you the full act. So we, six or seven of us, had the Humble Bums with Billy Connolly and Jerry Rafferty. But we all had to sing as many songs as possible just to fill it in. And I remember one of the songs that I sang, I eventually had to sort of go to, was The Patriot Game. The other one, his brother, Dominic Behan. That's all I remember about it, really. Well, fantastic, I do, I remember that.
So you sang in front of Billy
Connolly. I sang for Billy Connolly and Jerry Rafferty, yeah. They were great. They were really, because I suppose they were used to that sort of thing. And it didn't bother them as long as they got the money. So they just gave us the full works.
Yeah,
they weren't up themselves or anything, you know. They were quite happy to do it. So looking back now, we were pretty privileged.
Amazing, So what were you studying down there?
Comparative literature.
Right.
It's a four-year course.
So, I mean, I don't want to jump ahead so much, but you became a teacher. Was there any kind of teacher training done at that point?
No, I went on to Cardiff University and did teacher training there for a year.
Is that
straight from Essex? But in that time, I also went to Ireland. Myself and the bloke who ended up was my best man, Kev Borman. We were hitchhiking around Scotland, youth hostling in 1969 at the end of our first year at university. And we met these four Irish lads who were a year or two older than us and got together with them and travelled around with them for a bit. And they said, why don't you come across and see us in Ireland? And we'd never been to Ireland. So we went over on what was then called the cattle boat from Liverpool. Overnight, got onto North Wall at Dublin about 7 in the morning, went straight round to this lad's house. And he basically, you know, we were introduced to this fantastic group of people and to a scene which was really vibrant,
yeah,
the folk scene in Dublin, yeah, of the ballad clubs, yeah.
So that's, what we're talking, is this the early 70s?
Late, yeah, 60s? That's 69, 70, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. So, I mean, you're quite adventurous then, weren't you?
Well, I suppose so.
Was everyone doing it? Like, but, I mean, well, I suppose not, but everyone else from Grimsby was doing it.
No, 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 they weren't. People were starting to stretch their legs a bit, but I think we did probably a bit more travelling than most. And I, that was it. They invited us over. We went the following year. We went, that's right, it was 68 when we went, 69 when we went to Dublin. Met this crowd, hitchhiked round. They came and joined us. They were all working.
Yeah,
they,
yeah,
were, they were all a year or two older than us. They were all working, but yeah, we got to know them, and it was just wonderful. You know, I met a girl who I started going out with there as well. And
so you went quite often to Dublin.
I used to go then for a couple of years. Yeah, yeah. I used to go over in my school, my university holidays.
Yeah.
Hitchhike across to Holyhead, get the ferry across. And then go out to the west and various places. And
yeah,
that's how I got to know Ireland. And then I started to discover Irish music as opposed to ballads and songs and, you know.
Yeah. So it was interesting you were saying the ballad clubs, because, I'd not heard of the ballad clubs, but so they were basically like the folk clubs,
yeah,
but the Irish,
yeah,
version.
Yeah, the Irish
version. Because, yeah, I mean, that's a lot of Irish songs has got, oh, that's a great ballad, that one.
Yeah,
you know, like,
yeah,
the slower,
yeah,
Irish songs
are all
ballads.
Yeah, there was a different appreciation of the songs. It was a different way, slightly different culture. But it was essentially the same thing. You know, it's the same thing I'd been going to in Grimsby with John Connolly's club, John and the Broadside. So it wasn't an alien thing, and we'd had a folk club in the sixth form as well. So I was quite,
yeah,
used to the setup.
Yeah.
But I just discovered Irish music and an Ireland, which was the main thing. So when was that, 70? So we're talking 56 years ago.
Yeah. Well, it's probably time for you to give us a song, Phil, if you're okay. You're feeling...
Right. This is a song written by John Connolly. It's not Fiddler's Green, even though I think it's a wonderful song, but he did write a lot of other very, very good songs. And the reason I sing this is it's about Grimsby. It's about the decline of the trawling trade. And it sort of compresses the 30s through to the 80s, basically, and the decline and fall of the trawling trade. But it's a wonderful, wonderful song. So it's because of John Connolly, it's because of Grimsby, it's because of the link with John Connolly and Ireland through Fiddler's Green, and it's because I love it. So it's called... Willie, I'll come out in a minute. Willie, somebody, anyway. It's December 1933, and Willie Leonard's off to sea. He's off to Arctic waters where the deep sea trawlers roam. And the deckie's pay is counted in the sweat and that's frozen to his skin. But the best part's when he's heading back up river bound for home. Oh, he loved the lights of harbour, Willie Leonard, the raggle-taggle chorus of the evening seagull's call, and the rattle of the steam winch which rang like music in his ears as the ships lined up along the harbour wall. Well, it was boom time in the fishing trade. Big boats were built and fortunes made, and the owners built fine houses on the outskirts of the town. And the deckies paid 10 bob a day, but in 2 short nights it's boozed away. So sign on, lads, the choice is yours, it's starve or freeze or drown. Well, the harbour lights are calling, Willie Leonard. Another trip is over, but you're still alive and well. And the dockside pub's a shelter from the dark December nights and a haven from the frozen seeds of hell. Well, next the politicians shift and shout while the... While the owners pull their money out, and Iceland wins the fight to keep our vessels from her shore. But with rusty tubs and broken gear, and the fishing fleet of yesteryear, for the like of Willie Leonard, there's no future anymore. Well, do you miss the lights of harbour, Willie Leonard? Do you miss the sudden freedom of the fibres in your hand? Do you wonder who's to blame for all those dreams that never came when you try to make a living from the land? Well, now it's December 1985, and Willie Leonard's kept alive on social service handouts and a Sally Army bed. No pension, no redundancies, well, he's just an old man of the sea. But for all the trawler owners care, we might as well be dead. Well, he never told a soul where he was going, but the foreman on the dockside saw an old man shuffle by as he wandered amongst his memories to the place where they were made, as a broken creature crawls away to die. Did you see the lights of harbour, Willie Leonard? Did you listen to the engine churn the river into foam? Did you listen to the voices on the harbour side would sing, rolling home, Willie Leonard, rolling home?
Hey.
Now it's December 1992, and the old world's changed into the new. The winds of change are blowing like a mighty Arctic gale. Old skills are scorned and tossed aside like jet upon the ebbing tide, and the shadow of the 30s makes the northern lights grow pale. Well, he loved the lights of harbour, Willie Leonard, the raggle-taggle chorus of the evening seagull's call, and the rattle of the steam winch which rang like music in his ears, and the ships tied up along the harbour wall. Aye, the ships tied up along the harbour wall.
Oh, that's wonderful, wonderful. Well done. Thank you. Wow, it's got me there. It's emotional. And Willie Leonard, he's...
It's based on... Well, not one particular person, but there were, you know, some of the fishermen, that was it, you know, and they had nothing else to do.
Yeah.
And some of them just turned to drink. And there were cases of bodies being found in the dock.
You know, yeah.
Of men who maybe got drunk and gone to see their own place and fallen in, who knows.
But, no. The emotional is great that. And I think what I should say, that so it's my guest, Phil Tebbett, who's on Deserted Island Disc this week. Phil, as we've said earlier, he sings a couple of times a week at least in Fagin's. You can, and if you ask him to sing that song, I'm sure I'll do it for you. But also, you made a CD, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
A few years ago. Is that one on that one?
2023. I made it. I'd had the idea during lockdown. I decided to give it, you know, we all had lockdown plans, and one of mine was to just learn a song a month, new song. I mean, people think, you can learn it in a month. Believe me, able to sing a song properly,
I know,
I've got to take time.
Yeah, so it's all right singing it in your home, isn't it? But when you sing it in a pub and there's distractions, exactly. That's
and
the
you
habit.
Want to give it the right, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did that, and then I said to my wife, to Nora, I said, you know, I really want to make a CD. What do you think? If I do it properly, I'm going to spend some money on it. And she said, well, you don't spend much.
So,
go ahead. So I got her blessing. And she had cancer. And so I decided I would use it as a charity CD. And I basically raised money for Western Park. All the money I got for it, I raised for Western Park.
Yeah.
So, so I did that. And the other thing I wanted to do was... all the musicians that went into Fagin's and still go into Fagin's, some of them definitely lost quite important parts of their income because of that in that time. So I decided I was going to do it properly in a proper studio. I was going to get the right treatment and everything else. And the other thing I was going to do properly was pay them properly. So I found out from Chris Coates what the normal rates were, and I paid everybody the proper rates.
That's really nice of you, because I'm sure they would have done it for free, wouldn't
well,
they?
Well, maybe. Yeah, and some of them did say that. They didn't, but I didn't. I wanted to do it properly.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be fair, there was a selfish reason for this, and that was that I knew if I paid people the proper rates, they'd do a good
yeah,
job.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, I just thought, well, you know, they haven't had much money anyway.
Yeah.
And I wanted to bring some attention to the quality of the musicianship there
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, no, it's good. So is it... Can people buy it if they see you in Fagans? Is it kind of
yeah,
like
I've
that?
Got some copies left and they can buy me. And I won't probably won't have any with me at the time, but if they give me,
yeah.
If they give
we'll
me
sort
their
out
address,
that,
I can
yeah,
it
yeah,
yeah.
And is Willie Leonard on? It's on the.
It's on it.
It's
yeah,
on there.
With Alec says. Thompson playing the accordion on it. And
fantastic, and there's loads of yeah. great tracks on that. We're going to play one before the show ends. We are time's getting against us, Phil, yeah. And we need so much to get in. In your life, so basically, well, let's kind of jump to some of your travels, really. So you'd done Ireland, but then you went.
Well,
I
went into teaching. I came to Sheffield yeah. to start teaching. I'd been in the south for 5 years, and I wanted to come back up north. And at the time, in '73, it was pretty easy to get jobs. So I got a job at King Egbert's in Door, and we started playing music in the Broomhill Tavern on Friday and Saturday nights. Bunch of us, Hugh Waller, who used to lead the session on a Saturday in
Fagans.
And he was among them. And I was still had a bit of wanderlust in me. So I went to the Far East to Borneo to meet up with an ex to a girlfriend at the time, and then that didn't work out, so I stuck around and went to Japan and taught in Japan. And then in 1982 I decided I wanted to go back to the area, and took what was called a career break, although I saw it as something to add to my career. And I went and taught for VSO in Borneo again, in
right.
Indonesian Borneo, basically.
And so back then, I mean, not many people go to Borneo now, do they? But no. I mean, back then it must have been.
Well, it was, but I'd been before and I'd loved it, and so I just fancied going. And so the town I went to was a hick town. It was, you know, the only once you got there's one road in, and the only way to travel yeah. inland was on rivers. And I used to, and I worked for a Catholic mission. I was assigned to a Catholic mission in Samarinda, and they were brilliant. Priests yeah. were fantastic, and occasionally I'd have to go upriver for 2 or 3 weeks and work in a mission school, you know, on a
teaching English.
Yeah. And I had a wonderful time. I really enjoyed it. It's best one of the best things I ever did.
Sounds amazing. Yeah.
Well, apart from getting married, but I mean,
yeah, you'll get that. Well, then, so what was Japan like as well? So Japan, this is in the 80s.
Yeah, that was 79 to 80.
Yeah,
And I had a great time. I was in Tokyo and got work. I had to leave after 6 months and go and renew my visa in yeah. Seoul and come back. And I worked there for 7 or 8 months. Had a great time. Loved it. Loved Japan. It was like
yeah.
another planet. I just
I believe
it.
So, yeah. People say so, isn't it? It's yeah. Like, yeah, totally different. But again, yeah. I mean, I think it's still like that now, but I suppose back then as well, you'd be even less Westerners going there.
Well, yeah, there were plenty of Westerners there, but it was just, I mean, Japanese are very... Yeah. That, you know, they're not easily influenced, it's like the cultural side. I kept a journal and I wrote every day because I saw something new every day. I still dip into them and have a look at them, and I'm really pleased I did them, because there's stuff there that I've completely forgotten now.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, I feel bad rushing the show, but we're kind of getting towards 15 minutes left, and we need to talk about your wife. And so you yeah. came back from those travels.
Yeah, I came back from Indonesia. I met my wife. I'd known her for a number of years. We, you know, she was in the same crowd of people, but we got, you know, she was then, she'd been married, but the marriage had broken up. And then we just got together, and her name's Nora. And she was from South Derbyshire, from a village called Brassington, just north of Ashbourne. And her family had been there for 500 years, and she had a lovely old house there. Her mother was there still. And she was a nurse, or she started as a nurse, and then she rose through the NHS in Sheffield, ultimately getting the MBE for services yeah. to healthcare in Sheffield.
And she sadly passed away.
She passed away
two years ago.
Years ago. Yeah,
the cancer,
yeah.
I remember seeing you at the time,
yeah.
In the times, obviously. tremendously difficult times for you and the family, isn't it?
Yeah, but we've done a good job. We commemorate her often, and my daughters are brilliant at support, and I've got grandkids, and yeah, it's fine. It's what it is.
Yeah. Well, you said you just had a lovely weekend with the family. Who was there for the weekend?
All of us were away. It was my eldest daughter's 40th, my 76th, and my grandson's first. We had a fantastic weekend in Chillingham Castle in Northumberland, which was wonderful.
Wonderful. Yeah. Good stuff. Let's get another song in. So you've got The Lonesome Boatman. Why have you picked this one?
It's a tune I remember was really popular in Ireland when I was going over there the first time. It was a Finbar and Eddie Fury album called The Lonesome Boatman. There were some great songs on it. And it's just one of those things that takes me back instantly to those days, really.
Wonderful. Lonesome Boatman, the Furies. Fantastic. So that takes you back to Ireland, doesn't it? But one of the things we wanted to talk about is your kind of reconnection to Ireland over the last couple of years.
I lost touch with all the crowd in 1971, and I did try on a couple of occasions by the clumsy method of looking at phone books when I went to Dublin to get in touch with people, but there's quite a lot of Kennedys and people around. So I didn't actually make contact with them again. And I suppose as these things are, I assumed.
So to try and catch up when you physically went to Ireland and
Gone to Ireland anyway because I had a friend.
Yeah, but while you were there,
I looked in phone books in phone books. Remember those?
Yeah.
The next thing I know is Paul Kennedy, who was. He's always been somebody who's sort of got them organised and got things going. He'd retired and he was going through his old photos and digitalising them, and he came across a load of photos of us because we'd met up with him in Scotland. And he thought, he wondered where we were. And he realised, because he'd come across to Grimsby with Bill, and they'd come across to work in the frozen food factories in Grimsby to get some extra money to travel around Europe. And they stayed with us. And he'd spotted, miraculously, in the local paper that there was a Where Are They Now section.
Yeah.
So he wrote to the Grimsby Evening Telegraph and said, where are they now? Have anybody seen Phil Tabbett and Kev Borman? And unbeknown to us completely, and the next thing was it was occupying a full half page of the Grimsby Evening Telegraph with photos of us, embarrassing photos going back to when I was 19.
Yeah.
And within 10 minutes,
yeah,
he had email responses and he found us.
Yeah.
And he invited us over to go for a reunion. So we're talking 47 years since we'd seen him.
Amazing.
And he got all the crowd together in his house and we had this fantastic reunion. And I've been regularly seeing him ever since.
So you go back and forth. Yeah,
I go back every year, and it's now twice a year.
Yeah.
And see the crowd. And it's just wonderful. It's one of the best things. It's just I never thought it would happen.
Yeah, so yeah.
It's really, really.
And it was after your wife passed, was it?
No, it was before she passed away. I they'd wanted to see her. They wanted to come, and she said, "Look, this is nothing to do with me. This is your past.
Yeah,
just go and enjoy it." You know, and she would have felt out of place, even though she, you know, there's no way they'd have made her feel out of place.
Yeah, no.
But that's just the way she'd have felt about it anyway. So she was quite happy for me to go, and we did actually meet up with a couple of them. Actually came over to see us, and she sort of showed them around her home village and everything else, and it was great. It was wonderful that we did that. So that's it. I've been seeing them ever since.
So we're getting towards the end of the show. We've only got a few minutes just to kind of, I suppose, round up, but also kind of talk about how much of Fagin's has been part of your life, and then we're going to finish with a song that's on your CD. As well. So we've got a few minutes to talk about Fagin's.
Right. Well, Fagin's I started going to in 90. Well, I'd been to it before when Fagin was in charge and I'd sat in that snug and had a couple of drinks.
Oh, so you met the old Fagin?
I did meet him, yeah. But it was pretty quiet. It was towards the end of his career. And then Tom took over. I knew Tom from teaching because, I knew him, not personally, but I knew he was a teacher who'd retired and taken it over. So I started going around the time he took over, and then, but I was working.
So if people don't know, Tom and Barbara were there for 30 years,
38 years.
38 years,
And he said he went straight in there with the music, and as everybody knows, it became a big music hub, massive. And the level of musicianship was astonishing.
Yeah.
You know, and the people who used to play in there as well, and still do, and basically that was it. I used to go once a week on a Wednesday. I used to sometimes go and help support Hugh on a Saturday. Hugh used to do every Saturday night. And so I kept it. And then when I retired, I went a lot more regularly because I didn't have to get up at 6:30 in the morning. So I started going more regularly. So that was 2008. And I've been going ever since, and I just think it's, you know, I forget how good it is sometimes until I go there with somebody who's never been and says, God.
Just describe it to someone who's never been then. To the
Well, it's just spontaneous sessions. Different people lead the sessions on different nights, and there are certain things which are emphasised according to the person that leads it. But basically, you could sing what you want. There's nothing to say, you can't sing that tonight because we're having an Irish night, or you can't sing that tonight because it's Americana. Anybody can sing whatever they want, but whoever's leading the session tends to sort of lead it along their particular interests, all of which are good. So that's what I love about it, going back to my dad and, you know, the the wideness of his, of his music. The Fagans is like that.
Yeah, you know? That's it. It's on a Monday night, you have Chris who's...
Monday night, it's Chris who does Americana, but
And he's a piano player. He plays the piano and guitar. His repertoire is amazing. He knows so many songs.
Superb musician.
And, so the Wednesday night...
Tuesday night's Irish. Yeah. Wednesday night is a mix, depending on who's leading the session. There's five different people who do Wednesday night. Thursday night, I don't think there is a session, although Kath and Martin are trying to get one going. Yeah. Friday night is an Irish night, and then Saturday night is, again, a mixture, but it's pretty busy at the minute.
So a lot of the people that are playing on this next track are still playing there now. So
this particular...
Introduce the track.
Right, it's about as local as I could get, because it's the Girls of Glossop Road, which is a... variety show sort of thing that was written in the 1880s, and it's about the women who used to hang around outside the barracks, which is still there, because the soldiers were there, and they were basically how a volunteer would exploit the fact, but he got his comeuppance by the end of the song.
So it's a beautiful, cheery song.
Yeah, and it's got Tom Boldin's on it. Lots of people who are on the album are on it as well, singing the chorus.
All right, thanks, Phil. It's been wonderful. So
thank you very much.
Girls at Glossop Road.
Yeah. Now I'm just in the vein to sing a little strain, so pin your attention down to a tale I will tell of a Hallamshire swell I shall introduce as Brown. He was in the Rifle Corps, and I mustn't say more to you as you listen to me ode, but do the thing that's right all on a Sunday night with the girls up Glossop Road. With the girls up Glossop Road. With the girls up Glossop Road. Do the thing that's right all on a Sunday night with the girls up Glossop Road. Now Brown was a spark, rather fond of a lark, a married man though not chaste, and little he cared how his own wife fared if another girl took to his taste. So himself he then dressed in his regimental best, and proud as a peacock he strode, admiring the curls, the crinolines and pearls of the girls up Glossop Road. Of the girls up Glossop Road. Of the girls up Glossop Road. Admiring the curls, the crinolines and pearls of the girls up Glossop Road. Well, he accosted a fair with dark wavy hair, blue boots and a red leather belt, and he smiled and he talked as onward they walked, endeavouring her heart to melt. Then this sly volunteer gave a wink and a leer, inquiring of her name and abode, and he felt as grand as the lord of the land with the girls up Glossop Road. With the girls up Glossop Road. With the girls up Glossop Road. He felt as grand as a lord of the land with the girls up Glossop Road. Well, at length, Mr. Brown, with this girl he settled down in a neat little inn close by, where he ordered a drain of draught champagne and a quarter of cold pork pie. Then he huddled and pressed, close cuddled and caressed, and kisses he gave her a load, and he fell upon his knees just as swoony as you please with the girls up Glossop Road. With the girls up Glossop Road. With the girls up Glossop Road. And he fell upon his knees just as swoony as you please with the girls up Glossop Road. Now this quaint little man, well, he'd scarcely begun his love tale out for to pour,
When who should he see but his own Mrs. B peeping at the parlour door. With the bound of a bear, she fastened on his hair, crying out as her anger it arose, I'll tear out your eyes if you come to exercise with the girls up Glossop Road. With the girls up Glossop Road. With the girls up Glossop Road. I'll tear out your eyes if you come to exercise with the girls up Glossop Road. Well, to put matters right, these women had a fight and a right old-timer up and down. And they smashed to smithereens hats, coats and crinolines, and then they went to work on Brown. Well, he was jolly well thrashed, his head it got smashed, and the crowd their anger did bestow. And his fine uniform it went to blazes in the storm with the girls up Glossop Road. With the girls up Glossop Road. With the girls up Glossop Road. And his fine uniform it went to blazes.